You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of March 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, British Prime Minister David Cameron has been accused of ducking TV debates ahead of May's general election. But will broadcasters carry out their threat to empty chair him? Benjamin Netanyahu is back in Israel after delivering his controversial speech to the US Congress.
I return to Israel knowing that Israel's concerns regarding the impending deal with Iran are better understood. That the deal currently on the table is deeply flawed.
Back in Washington, he's left behind a growing row over the Iran nuclear talks. But what impact did his speech have in Israel? And finally, do mothers make the best spies? Teenagers may think so. So too, apparently, do spy chiefs. My guests today, breaking cover, are Daniela Peled and Ivor Gaber. They'll be giving us their views on those stories and more. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. First, though, let's take a look at some of the day's top headlines so far. A military operation to retake the Iraqi city of Tikrit from ISIS has caused about 28,000 people to flee their homes so far, according to the United Nations. A Delta Airlines jetliner with 125 passengers aboard has slid off the runway at New York's LaGuardia Airport during a snowstorm. There are no reported injuries. The US ambassador to South Korea, Mark Lippert, has been slashed in the face by a Korean nationalist, but was not seriously hurt during an attack at a breakfast forum held in the capital today to discuss Korean unification. Japanese and Chinese officials are due to hold their first security talks in 4 years in Tokyo later this month. That's according to Japan's foreign ministry. My guests today are Daniela Peled, editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting and a contributor to Haaretz, among others, and Ivor Gaber, professor of journalism at Sussex University. Daniela and Ivor, welcome both to Midori House. British Prime Minister David Cameron has announced he will only take part in one televised election debate during the upcoming general election. According to Downing Street, Cameron is only prepared to participate in just one debate, which has to involve at least 7 party leaders. The ultimatum has drawn criticism from his opponents, who believe it's nothing more than an attempt to avoid a head-to-head debate with Labour leader Ed Miliband. Ivor Gaber, this is something that journalists and broadcasters get very exercised about and think is outrageous, and that definitely David Cameron, he'll pay a price for this. Do most people, most voters, actually care?
Yes and no. I'm not sure he'll pay a price for it in terms of the ultimate vote, but all the polls show that people did like the leaders' debates. They watched them in big numbers for British TV, 10 million. And I think they played a role, some say a destructive role, in terms of blotting out the rest of the campaign. So I think people did like it, and in terms of democracy, it obviously is an enhancement, or at least I think it was. However, one-offs like this, so to speak, don't actually determine the vote. People's voting decisions are very complex and many factors come into play. So Cameron's taking a gamble. He fears, I guess, that by attending a debate with one or two people, he might come off second best, whereas with 7 or 8, he thinks, you know, he'll get lost in the crowd.
Daniela Peled, David Cameron runs the risk of looking a little bit slippery, but some people would say, actually, people already think he's perhaps a little bit slippery, so therefore it maybe doesn't matter too much.
Look, he's taking a calculated risk. Will it be more damaging to be viewed as a chicken for not entering into these debates? Or be more damaging to enter into debate, I think, especially with Ed Miliband, and come off worse? I mean, it seems a strange, counterintuitive decision for a man whose oratorial skills have always been, you know, pretty on the ball. The idea of a 7-part debate is kind of ludicrous.
Well, it happens in Denmark, it happens in Sweden, in Finland, and they seem to work fairly well.
That's the thing. It doesn't fit in with the British model of politics. I remember the 2010 debate, and they were kind of event television. I remember sitting around in the pub, we were all watching and sort of catcalling, and that was something new and novel and very exciting. Now, with 7, I that would just descend into war. I mean, it's just not, it doesn't meld with the British system. I don't think it will pay off for any of the main candidates.
It can work, but you're absolutely right. In a multi-party system, I saw it Dallon Borgen, the Danish political thriller. It looked very good then. You're going to tell me that wasn't real.
Their politicians are also better looking.
Oh no, don't worry. I was going to bring up a West Wing example in a moment, so you carry on.
And it does work. The US does have to some extent a two-party system, and they did when Ross Perot, for example, was around, have three-person debates. It can work, I guess, to the extent that any debate throws a bit of light. But I think Cameron's calculation, precisely because he has got good oratorical skills, he can only lose, because if Ed Miliband doesn't make a complete idiot of himself, Miliband will have seen to have done, oh, he did okay, whereas it's assumed that Cameron will win. So I think it's quite a clever calculation. Whether the BBC, the national broadcaster, will have the courage, I don't know. They've said they're going to empty chair Cameron. Mm. That's a big decision for them to take. It's a politically controversial decision. Empty chair, leave his chair empty and say he didn't turn up. They've said they're going to do it. I think it's going to be fascinating to see whether they do.
Now, Daniela, it's one thing to empty chair the Prime Minister when it means there is one empty podium out of seven. It's another thing because the broadcaster's original plan was two debates with seven party leaders, and then one debate head to head with the two men who stand any chance of becoming Prime Minister, David Cameron and Ed Miliband. Can there really be a debate where Ed Miliband debates with himself? I mean, I'm sure he probably debates with himself all the time. He seems like that kind of man. But would Channel 4, who are supposed to be broadcasting that one, be able to actually do that?
No, I mean, that's just grandstanding, isn't it? That's not going to happen. And I think you know, Ivan makes a good point. Ed Miliband can only surprise people positively, really. He doesn't have such great great ratings when it comes to personal appeal. And really, when it comes down to it, this isn't going to be about personality, is it? It's going to be about the economy. It's going to be about party politics much more than sort of any kind of presidential race. Again,
although that it becomes that if the debates don't happen, it will those issues will become more important than, you know, who do we want personality wise as Prime Minister if there are no debates.
Well, I think it is a gamble. I think it may pay off in Cameron's favour. So quite, I mean, this does make him look a bit slippery. This does make him look like a bit of a coward. But fundamentally, I don't think it's going to make an enormous difference.
Ivor Gaber, it was the last election was the first time that the UK had these debates. And lots of people are talking about it now as if it was some great thing for democracy. But I also remember those debates. Yes, they were fun to watch. But then we just talked about who won the debate. Not about, hang on, what did David Cameron say or what did Gordon Brown or Nick Clegg say, but simply who was up and who was down.
Well, that's exactly the point, for good motives or otherwise, that David Cameron makes, that he didn't want the debates to dominate the election campaign, he said, as they did last time. You're absolutely right that the normal campaigning, which does involve in the UK more conversation about issues than in many other countries. I mean, obviously there's other personality and so forth comes into it. And Cameron makes the point, and we'll take him at his word, that the debate formula last time precluded significant issue discussion. For example, the big issues that dominated since 2010, public spending cuts, taxation. I did some research on it. There was not a single party used the word cuts in any of its press releases during the campaign. They could get away with it because, as you said, the media's focus was on who's going to win, who's winning, who won.
Daniela Pellad, if you had to bet on it right now, are we going to see debates?
If I had to bet, I would say not, because I think that the sort of seven-party bun fest, oh, actually, it would make great television, but I don't think Labour or Conservatives will really come out too well from that.
Okay. It seems that the speech that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made to the US Congress may have paid off. Not necessarily because it's going to have any impact on the Iran nuclear talks, but it has apparently shoved the Israeli election polls somewhat in his favour. With less than 2 weeks before the elections on the 17th of March, he appears to be now running neck and neck with his rival Isaac Herzog of the Labour Party and Zionist Union. Daniela Pellad, this speech was at 11 a.m. in Washington, which just happened to be 6 p.m. In Israel, prime time, shown on TV. This was all about the election, wasn't it?
You won't hear any argument from me. It was all about the election. It was a gamble because there was also a lot of criticism at home about Netanyahu's stance and making the issue of Israel a partisan issue in America, which is a real, you know, it's a sort of no-go area. And also alienating here Israel's most important strategic ally and so on and so forth. But of course, it played to another sector of his constituency who saw him as standing up to the world and the only man that can look after Israel and so on. His speech was, you know, it was a great speech. I don't know how many ovations there.
23 standing
right.
ovations.
Well, great. In the speech, you know, it pushed all the buttons. It even had a Game of Thrones reference. Now, all that needed to do for him, it needed to get him two extra Knesset seats for him to have a chance of forming the next government. I mean, that's all. And now we're saying maybe one or two. It might pay off. But I really think from the polls I've been reading that the difference at the moment is still too slight. I mean, I think it's likely that he will be the one forming the next government, but I don't think that this speech was the decisive factor.
Ivor Gaber, going back to what we were discussing before about the TV debates in the UK, I mean, this sort of event, this big speech that's going to be televised in prime time, is exactly the sort of thing that a political leader wants to have in the run-up to an election, isn't it?
It is, but I think political leaders around the world overstress the importance of one-off events and even overstress the importance of the media. In Israel, people mostly are voting on tough economic issues, cost of living, unemployment and so forth. The obviously the geopolitical issues feature as well. But if you look at the polls, people talk about the harsh divisions between rich and poor in Israel, which are getting stronger. And although clearly the Israel-Palestine and the broader dispute features as well, I don't think people are, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think people are just voting on that issue. They've got lives to live. They've got to try and go to the supermarket and see prices going up. They go to see their wages slip, not meeting the cost of living. I mean, the cost of living crisis in Israel is harsh at the moment.
Daniel Pard, are there, in a sense, sort of two campaigns going on in Israel at the moment? You know, Benjamin Netanyahu and Likud would like it the conversation to be about national security, and you vote for me and I will keep you safe and then we'll talk about the other things. Whereas Isaac Herzog and Tzipi Livni are more focused on what Ivor's saying there about, you know, people can't afford their rent, people can't buy their first houses, these sorts of underlying economic issues.
Likud's campaign so far has focused on security, with then some more security in case anyone doubted whether Netanyahu could bring security. I mean, that's it. All the way. There has been a series of rather ridiculous skit adverts, like these comic spoofs, and one of them involved a gang of Islamic State fighters being shown the way to Jerusalem by some useless Israeli leftist.
Who says, yeah, they pull up alongside them and say, which way to Jerusalem? They say, oh, it's to the left.
Yeah, exactly. That's what happens. I mean, that is the sort of basis of the Likud argument. Social issues really don't get a look in. On the other hand, the last elections, then leader of the Labour Party took a strategic decision to only campaign on social issues and really not mention the occupation, not mention security. And that backfired on Labour last time around. That really didn't work. And the Meretz Party, which is more to the left, did quite well, I think, out of voters saying, well, no, it's not all about social issues. And I think that is where everyone, all of Netanyahu's political rivals, and not from the left or from the centre-left, but also Shas and also all the other more minority parties, are attacking him on social welfare and the fact that there is an enormous gap between rich and poor, and there's a housing crisis, and you know, and that from that point of view, Israel seems to be in freefall.
Is there an argument, perhaps, Ivor, that while this didn't work for the centre-left last time, that right now? Yeah, because we can all look at examples from history where people have focused on, you know, I'm a strong leader, and actually people go, you know what, it's peacetime now, we'd far rather you focus on economic issues. Do you feel that actually those underlying issues are more to the fore now than they might have been last time?
Well, one of the interesting things about the current campaign is the fact that there's, for the first time in recent times, is there's a United Arab List. And they could be the third biggest bloc. And they don't want to campaign on security issues, obviously. They are trying to increase turnout of Arab voters, which is always significantly below Jewish voters. And I think that they are throwing some of the debate into that area. Their focus is just to get, I mean, they're not going to be part of any government, but they can have a significant role in denying either Likud. Well, they could work with Labour. They've worked with a Labour government in the past. They would certainly not work with a Likud government. So I think the social issues play to their strengths as opposed to the security issue.
I don't think anyone in Israel, apart from Palestinian citizens of Israel, are paying any attention to the United List. They don't really feature. They're
I don't think they come third.
No. I'm saying in talking about the debate, in talking about the political debate, they aren't really there. They're kind of outside the consensus, and they're not seen as taking away votes from any of the other main parties, apart from in a very marginal sense. And that's the thing. You know, there are debate shows in Israel, and very rarely will you see somebody from the Arab List on the United List. They don't exist. That's not what this election is about.
But isn't it the first time there's been a United Arab List?
Yeah, sure. But I mean, that's also very problematic, because before you had, for instance, you had Hadash, which is an Israeli Jewish and Arab party, a communist party, a non-Zionist party, but not an Arab nationalist party. And that's one where many left-wing Israeli Jews felt comfortable voting for. Now you have a coalition which includes quite a wide range of nationalistic views that I don't think Jewish Israelis feel they've got a home there.
We're going to be talking about this issue in a bit more detail on this week's Foreign Desk, which is 12 noon here in London, obviously on the website as well. Daniela, on this issue of what happens after the election if Netanyahu loses, what sort of government might Herzog and Livni form? Because this Zionist Union is already, as the name suggests, a union between two parties and two sort of political ideas that don't necessarily always fit together. Although you're making a face.
Yeah, I'm making a face because I think we are, you know, in Israel, we are like many other places in the era of post-ideological politics. I think the idea is it would be a centrist leftist government, which could include Yesh Atid, which is very anti, you know, like non-ideological. You could include the left of the Labour Party. It could Meretz, who are the left-wing Labour Zionists. What would happen, really, if Herzog formed a government? The international community would go crazy with delight, thinking that now everything would change. Would anything change? I'm a little bit cynical about that, but frankly, to be even more cynical, I don't think we're going to be faced with that prospect anyway.
There we are, a little bit of cynicism. Before we take a break, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. I'll be back in a moment discussing Hillary Clinton's emails, and also we'll be asking whether mothers make the best spies. Stay tuned.
Every March, Monocle puts the spotlight on one nation, and this time, it's the turn of Japan. As the country looks forward to welcoming the world at the 2020 Olympic Games, we focus on the challenges facing modern Japan. Here's what our editors have reported on.
In the design section, we trek the length and breadth of Japan to discover its craft capitals, those towns known in true Japanese style for making one thing and making it well.
In the edits pages, we follow the Sumida River to Tokyo's Old Town to profile the up-and-coming Kuramai neighbourhood.
The March issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Or become a subscriber. Head to monocle.com to find out how.
The Monocle Daily sets the agenda in Asia and considers what's been dominating the day in Europe and North America.
The programme is often co-hosted out of our Toronto and New York bureau and features regular interviews with special guests both there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London.
Monocle 24's regular weekly guide to the perfect Friday night in includes some of our favourite cities around the world and features the insights of the people who know those places best, our unrivalled network of correspondents.
Join me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Your regular hosts for the Monocle Daily every weekday at 6 a.m. in Tokyo, 2200 hours in London.
And And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, still with me, Daniela Pellad and Ivor Gaber. In the United States, Hillary Clinton has found herself in the middle of a controversy after it emerged that she used a private email address instead of a government one during the 4 years she spent as Secretary of State. She has responded to this scrutiny over her practices, saying that she has asked the State Department to publish her emails from that period. Her advisers apparently have already submitted some 50,000 pages of material to the State Department. One of those figures that I think probably sounds bigger than it really actually is. Ivor Gaber, it's a bit strange, this, using her private email address, having her own personal server. I mean, it's almost as if she knew that the NSA liked to collect data.
Well, I've got another theory based on absolutely no knowledge at all, except the fact that her husband, you might recall, Mr. William Clinton, spent much of the last of his term in office mired in controversy, which followed him, whether it was financial, sexual or any other sort. And I just wonder whether the Clintons decided some time ago that there was too much transparency around, and that they were going to sort of close themselves off and have their own server and their own email. I mean, we've all got own email addresses, but their own server. And I just wonder, and of course, Hillary was thinking, as we know, we're not thinking, was an active campaigner for the presidency in 2008. So they've long been in the spotlight, and it seems to me, on the one hand, a sensible thing. On the other hand, becoming Secretary of State and all the implications for national security, it's sort of odd that nobody in the State Department said, Hillary, it's like having a Hotmail address, isn't it, almost? Is this entirely
Hillary.Clinton84 at Hotmail.com? Yeah. I'm guessing, I don't know.
It's just odd. I mean, I suspect that was
their
motive.
I think she's more of a Yahoo person, to be honest, I think.
I got it. She's a Gmailer. Anyway, okay. I just think it's odd that nobody in the state said, hey, Hillary, what's going on?
Daniela, is this one of these things that actually matters? There is something about it. Or is this just a sort of, because I remember this came out and it was maybe like the second or third Hillary story I'd seen on a front page in the past week. There'd been something about donations to the foundation. There'd be some other stuff as well. Is this just part of what we're now going to see in the run-up to 2016 of pretty much every week there will be some sort of Hillary scandalish story?
Well, yeah, I think it is. I think it's exactly that. And it depends now how she and her team handles it, because it appears she didn't actually do anything wrong. You know, the guidelines, or the, maybe there were guidelines when she was Secretary of State, but then the rules came in after she was no longer in that position. What this contributes to is this kind of sense of unease about her, sense of the idea of transparency, the idea of the idea of being of aloofness, the idea of being special. I mean, again, security breaches, I don't know. You know, there's been nothing even suggested that actually anything definite did happen. But yeah, it's a kind of, and it's not even quite a smear either. It's a little nudge to the idea that Hillary isn't quite on the level.
Interesting Clinton email fact for you. Do you know that Bill Clinton was the first head of state to ever send an email to another head of government, and that was to Carl Bildt when he was Prime Minister of Sweden.
Well, another
interesting fact is that, not that I'm spreading, Tony Blair never mastered emails when he was in Downing Street. They all had to be printed off for him.
Yes, indeed. And he didn't even, he never sent a text message until he stepped down as being Prime Minister. He didn't have a mobile phone.
I don't know how they're so proud of this. This is somehow something, this is a bonus that our leaders
technology,
will
I knew nothing about that at all. So, I mean, Daniel, you say, you know, there is going to be a sort of constant sort of slew of stories about Hillary Clinton as she sort of gears up to run, which is obviously clearly going to happen. If she wasn't going to run, she would have said by now, yeah, not for me. Do you think that actually the people that count initially, Democratic primary voters, are really going to worry about any of these issues, or are just going to see this as Hillary's being attacked again? We're not going to, it might even help her with those voters.
It might do, but I think this is about a long game. This is about building the idea of Hillary as again, not on the level, you know, something to hide. After all, her husband had that kind of reputation clinging to him as well. So I don't think with Democratic primaries, it will make a great deal. But I think it's part of this campaign, which is going to begin. And really, a lot a lot depends on how she is going to handle it. And the release of the emails, you know, 50,000 emails, great, shows that she has nothing to hide. But I don't think that's what it's about. I think it's actually about secrets. I think it's about image.
I think it's also about substance. In the advertising profession, they have an expression, banging on the bruise, where you've made an impact and you just keep reminding people. And of course, what this email relates to in terms of Republican propaganda is reminding people about Benghazi, that probably the biggest foreign policy disaster, if that's not too big a word, that she presided over. And I think they want to constantly keep that issue going. In fact, they're talking about using it to have an inquiry, to reopen the inquiry and so forth. So I think that is certainly about general doing Hillary down, but it's certainly Benghazi as a symbol of she is not to be trusted.
Okay, finally, a new report suggests that Britain should hire middle-aged mothers as spies. The Intelligence and Security Committee in the UK says that more diversity is crucial if the security services are to address all threats facing the country. And therefore, this is why agencies should target websites which are popular amongst parents. Mumsnet, which is apparently very popular with mothers, is one of those named. Danielle, this is one of those things that sort of sounds a little bit silly, but...
Because it is.
But there is a serious point behind this, which is that certainly in this country, MI6, MI5 have been traditionally, old boys from Eton, from Cambridge, from Oxford. And in the last 20 years, there have been attempts of a sort to open it up, having adverts, for example, for people to apply, which didn't used to be the case. You no longer just have to be tapped on the shoulder by the right person, and try and find people that are, more representative of the people they're spying on, as it were.
Well,
tempted?
Yes. I hold my hands up. I am a middle-aged mother, I think I'll stick to journalism. This is a headline grabber, but not what I think is a little bit silly about this. Not just the implication that mothers and women read Mumsnet, obviously more than they might read The Guardian or any other website, of which many are available. But the thing is, women are not properly 50-50 represented in this service, but they're not doing too badly. I think who they need to more actively recruit are people from ethnic minorities, people from a variety of backgrounds. Exactly as you said, not the old boy school network. It's not about gender here, is it? It shouldn't be about gender.
I'm trying to come to terms with this image, actually, of the name's Bond, Janet Bond. It really does blow a hole in the whole notion of the British Secret Service as it was these smooth young men, or not so young
and
men.
Yet Stella Rimmington ran MI5.
Imagine having a black Bond as well. Who would ever think such a thing?
I do have a theory that if Jihadi Johnny had been questioned by a nice, cuddly mumsy, he wouldn't have turned into the monster he was, but that's speculation.
I think that's speculation, yeah. Daniela, on that point of having more of a representative sample of people within the security services, it's one of those issues which is quite tricky, because often people from those communities think the last thing I want to do is work for those guys.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the challenge. I mean, it's not something that can be addressed by a sort of dinky advertising campaign or anything like that.
OK, we will leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today, Danielle Pad and Ivor Gaber. Midori House was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by David Pleasant and Mike Hewin. The studio manager was Wei Dong Lin. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours in London, 1300 hours in New York City. Tom Edwards is next, and then it's The Urbanist at 1900 hours. Stay tuned. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.